Last week, in our study, we looked at punishments for crimes against property, and then we transitioned to punishments for crimes against persons, bodily injury, and last week, particular murder. And we looked at the death penalty. In particular, we talked about how it was initiated with Noah. It was expanded under the Mosaic Law. And we pointed out that regardless of what you think about the continuing relevance of the Mosaic Law, at least in regard to murder, there's no reason for us to not think that it would be in effect. And we might debate some particulars about the application of Mosaic Law in regard to the death penalty. But we see the general abiding validity of it. Okay? Something that always comes up in the context of that study is, what about the woman caught in adultery? In regard to the woman taken in adultery, where we read about in John 8, the Pharisees come to Jesus with a capital crime. They explicitly say, you know, the law says that this woman should be stoned to death. She was caught in the very act. What do you say? And, of course, Jesus famously says, you know, he who is without sin, or better, without fault in the matter, let him cast the first stone. And so oftentimes it's supposed that Jesus does not impose the penalty the law required. And in doing so, Jesus did away with capital punishment. In response to this, the way that people often get out of the question of Jesus' response is by saying that the story of the woman taken in adultery is not authentic. My Bible has a note at the bottom of the pericope, so as it's called. Says these verses are not present in some Greek manuscripts, and in others they appear at different locations, such as after 7:36 or even in Luke. The NIV and most other modern translations that are based on a different set of Greek manuscripts are usually more forceful. They say something like, the earliest and most reliable manuscripts and other ancient witnesses do not have John 7:53 through 8:11. And so the question of what Jesus does here is avoided because it's thought that this passage is inauthentic. Let me say, I believe it's authentic. I believe that the overwhelming manuscript evidence is in support of it. There's a long debate over the manuscript traditions that we use. But above all, I think God has promised to keep his word pure in all ages, and for that reason, I'm persuaded that the passage is authentic. And I think if we look at it closely, we'll see there's a beauty to this text, and no real reason to think of it as being other than inspired. I shared this maybe Ben was here, whatever, long, long time ago. We preached a sermon on this text, and the pews obviously were here. But I thought it would do well to revisit this situation. What do we make of the story of the woman taken in adultery? Well, first thing I want to point out is we need to understand that this episode occurs during the Feast of Tabernacles, which commemorated the wilderness wanderings, and more specifically, the whole episode takes place in the temple court, and that too is very important. Jesus has come to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles, a feast that made a lot of emphasis on water, how God provided water in the wilderness for the people who were there, and also a festival that made use of light, the symbolism of light, because of that glory cloud, the light that led people through the wilderness. Okay, so there's some of the symbolism that's associated with this feast. John tells us that during this time, there's some tensions emerge between Jesus and the Pharisees. You know, most of the time Jesus spent up in Galilee conducting his ministry. He generally only went down to Jerusalem for the annual feast. Had he stayed in Jerusalem, Jesus' ministry would have been cut short. Now, Jesus, of course, he has a schedule he's on, and his ministry is purposely going to last 3.5 years. And so Jesus will avoid the authorities oftentimes and spend more time up in Galilee and only make appearances occasionally down in Jerusalem. And so we see one of those occasions in which Jesus is in Jerusalem. There's a lot of tension going on at the end of chapter 7. And this carries over into chapter 8. The Pharisees are trying to have Jesus arrested. And in this episode, they come to him with a case law, basically, and they ask for his ruling. And John lets us know they're not interested in the sanctity of the law. What they're interested in is trapping Jesus in something. And let me begin. I'll start with chapter 8, verse 2. It says, "Now early in the morning..." I'm at John chapter 8, verse 2. "Now early in the morning, he came again into the temple. And all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, 'Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say?'" Okay? So they're bringing, you know, here Jesus is. He's publicly teaching. They've got a question for him. All right. Notice what John says in verse 6. "This they said, testing him, that they might have something in which to accuse him." Okay. So this is a question like, are you still beating your wife? You know, how do I answer that? Yes or no? I mean, either which way, I'm trapped. All right. It says, "But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said to them, 'He who is without sin among you, or literally it's without fault, let him throw a stone at her first.' And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground." We're told that twice. Why? "Then those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest even to the last. And Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, 'Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?' She said, 'No one, Lord.' And Jesus said to her, 'Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more.'" Now notice that. Well, I'm not condemning you, but he says, go and sin no more. I think Jesus knows the woman was guilty of what she had done by saying that, but without the appropriate accusers, you can't proceed with any conviction. But notice this, "Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, 'I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have light.'" Okay? A lot of interesting things going on here. The point that we need to make right now is, it's obviously the Pharisees and scribes are trying to get Jesus on something. And John tells us that they're trying to trap him. We know that it was a time of moral laxity, so it would be very questionable whether Jesus would enforce, if he enforces the law, you know, he's going against the tenor of the day. If he calls out for something else, then he's in violation of the law. He's at odds with Moses, and therefore he's discredited in the eyes of the people. If he begins the process, which of course he had no authority to do as one who was not a civil magistrate, he's in trouble with the Romans, because they reserve for themselves the right of capital punishment. Okay? So it's one of those questions that they present to him that doesn't appear to have an easy way out at all. It's obviously they're trying to trap him, and John specifically tells us that. Okay? Now, it's true the law had called for the execution of people for the sin of adultery. I'm at the very bottom of the first page there, letter F. And it says, Moses writes in Leviticus 20:10, the man who commits adultery with another man's wife, he commits adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and adulteress shall surely be put to death. Okay? So that's what the law says. Now, in John 3, we're told that the woman was allegedly caught in the very act. But the law says both the adulterer and adulteress are to be put to death. So here's another technicality that the Pharisees are trying to get Jesus on. Okay? Where was the man? Okay, you can't commit adultery by yourself. She's caught in the very act. They bring the woman to Jesus. What do we do with her? Well, the man's not there. And the law says both the man and the woman. Okay? So even here, what they're doing with the law is a twisting and perversion of it. All right? Now, it's at this point people oftentimes think Jesus does away with the law. Well, he who is without sin, let him throw a stone at her first, okay? Which one of you aren't guilty of doing something wrong in your life at one time? You know, Jesus is all about grace and mercy, right? That's it. He never enforces the law, all right? In reality, what Jesus is doing here is he's calling for the full application of the law. He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. So that the word that it's used there is not the typical word for sin. It's a word that's used back in Deuteronomy 19 in the Septuagint for a fault. Okay, it's a little different word. But I want us to just think about, this matter of trying to apply Jesus' words here in a blanket sort of way. He is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone. If it's taken to mean that you may never convict someone of a crime, if you yourself have ever been guilty of sin at all, then we would completely do away with any criminal justice system at all. No judge, no juror, no witnesses could ever serve in a court, because all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So just on the surface, that sort of notion that this is what Jesus is doing here, I think is undermined by everything else that we know about the continuing validity of the law. In other words, Jesus is not advocating absolute sinlessness in order to be able to serve as a witness in this case. Again, if that were the case, no one could ever be a witness. Let me read letter I here. Rather than dismantling the law, Jesus was actually appealing to it. According to God's law, witnesses in capital cases must not be guilty of the particular crime themselves. Deuteronomy 19:15 reads, one witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. Okay? If you're guilty of that crime, you cannot serve as a witness in that. This is Matthew Henry writes. This is a good old Matthew Henry commentary. Christ builds on an uncontested maxim in morality, that it is very absurd for men to be zealous in punishing the offense of others while they are every whit as guilty themselves. And they are not better than self-condemned who judge others and yet themselves do the same thing. Okay? I think this is what Jesus is appealing to. If you're free from wrongdoing in this matter, you're not guilty of this situation, then you may serve as witness. The fact that they've already violated the law by bringing the woman and not the man makes them, it disqualifies them. Well, I think there's other things that disqualify them as well. Okay? Beyond that, we should note the following. When Jesus says, let him cast the first stone, that too is an allusion back to the law. in who the law prescribed to cast the first stone. Letter J. Furthermore, according to the requirements of the law, the witnesses were to begin the act of execution. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people. Okay? So you're a witness to a crime, and you've sworn testimony to this effect. You play a role in the execution of the criminal. Okay? So if they were justifiable witnesses, they should have cast the first stone. And then the community joins in with that. Okay? Says, hence Christ's statement, I'm in the middle of J, he is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first, is simply a quote from the Old Testament. The court witnesses, innocent of that particular crime, were to begin the process of capital punishment. This is what Jesus appealed to. But the scribes and Pharisees, John says, convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest to the last. All right? Jesus, in other words, he turns the table on them. Okay? He convicts their consciences because they themselves are guilty of the same thing. So this is just one of two things. The women's accusers either were not witnesses or else they were guilty of adultery themselves, more likely the latter. Okay? I want us to think about this. There's a reason Jesus goes around constantly, you know, calling them a wicked and adulterous generation. A lot of times we think that just metaphorically, you know, worshiping other gods or something like that. I think it's more than that. Everything we know of the Pharisees is they were just corrupt to the core. And I want to stress this because nowadays we oftentimes hear people talking about how scrupulous, how righteous the Pharisees were. Yeah, they were scrupulous in little things that they did for show and, you know, tithing on their herb gardens and all that. But fundamentally, every confrontation that we read about with the Pharisees, we see these are wicked, evil, power-hungry, envious men who are, you know, willing to subvert the law left and right if it furthers their cause. And I want to stress this because a lot of times we hear today people, pastors rank, you know, they make comparisons of faithful Christians to Pharisees, and you know, we all know there's some Pharisee in all of us, right? And we're self-righteous and we're prideful and all that. Now, that's true. But the Pharisees, it wasn't just people struggling with their sins. These were unbelievers, okay? If they had believed Moses, they would have believed Jesus. And they're wicked men. And I think we need to see it that way. Jim, I got a quote here from Jim Jordan. He says this, letter K. We are not used to thinking of the scribes and Pharisees as meticulous. We are used to thinking of the scribes and Pharisees as meticulous men who carefully observe the jots and tittles. This is not the portrait found in the Gospels. The scribes and Pharisees that Jesus encountered were grossly, obviously, flagrantly breaking the Mosaic law while keeping all kinds of man-made traditions. Jesus' condemnation of them in Matthew 23 certainly makes this clear, as does a famous story in John 8. There we read that the scribes and Pharisees brought to Jesus a woman taken in the very act of adultery. How did they know where to find her? Where was the man who was caught with her? Apparently he was one of their cronies. Also, when Jesus asked for anyone without sin, this is not guilty of the same crime, to cast the first stone, they all went away because they were all adulterers. I think that's a much more likely scenario than anything else. They were adulterers themselves. Again, this story, you know, it's not clear. We don't know if this was one of his cronies or not. But if you look at Matthew 23, when Jesus goes through this long list of things that the Pharisees do, I mean, they were like the daggone politicians in Washington who are willing to lie to both sides of their mouth, do anything, subvert the law, whatever it took to further their agenda. Yeah, Paul. I don't know that they did.
Unless you're righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, even though wise men are in heaven. They were all kind of perplexed. Like, who can be more righteous than the scribes and Pharisees? So why were they so blinded to
I don't know that they all were. We know there was a lot of, they were presented that way. And they were the teachers of the synagogues. And there were exceptions. There were people like Nicodemus, etc. You know, Jesus stereotypes them as a group as being pretty wicked. But we know, for example, like there were people like the Essenes, from which we get the Dead Sea Scrolls, who kind of dropped out of society. They saw the Sadducees in league with the Romans. The Pharisees were corrupt, and they went out by the Dead Seas, and they formed their own community because they saw the system as corrupt. So I don't know that everybody, you know, yes, to some extent, you know, they were taught by the Pharisees in the synagogues, but, And they were taught wrongly oftentimes to say that what's important are all these traditions, rather than the weightier matters of the law. And so they were meticulous about all these little things that basically distracted from the important things they should have done. So like when Jesus talks about Korban, when they would basically, they would dedicate their belongings to the temple, and make it look like, look how holy I am, because I have wheeled everything up to the temple. But the way they structured the law, they got to enjoy all their belongings. And then when they died, everything went to the temple. But they used that, Jesus said, as a way to subvert caring for their parents in their old age. So like if their parents needed help, they would basically like, well, too bad, this is all dedicated to the temple. We can't do this for you. I mean, like I said, it was things like that. Yes.
Paul says he's a Pharisee of the Pharisees. He calls himself that Pharisee of the Pharisees. I guess in terms of keeping the law, trying to keep the law.
Yeah, I'm trying to. Well, Paul there is trying to, you know, prove his Jewishness. You know, against the Judaizers who are insisting on the Gentiles be circumcised, and you know, like who's more Jewish? And he's like, look, I was a Pharisee, I was this and that. Do you have a question in there somewhere?
No, he was just referencing.
So, like I said, I mean, there were some. And let me point this out in Acts 15. In Acts 15, when the beginning of Jerusalem Council, it says, where is it? But verse 5, but some of the sect of the Pharisees who believed rose up saying, it is necessary to circumcise them, etc. So there were Pharisees who believed. Just like, I think there are some good politicians, you know, There clearly are, but as a whole, as a group, Jesus in Matthew 23, he really stereotypes them as a group as being a really corrupt bunch. There were people like Nicodemus, there were some of the Pharisees who believed, etc. I think as a group, though, they were pretty corrupt.
So where was that 15?
Where was what? Oh, Acts 15:5. That's at the Jerusalem Council. There were some of the Pharisees who did believe. Okay. All right. I think what they're doing to here to Jesus in John 8 is a testimony of that. All right, let's look over at page 3, letter L. Let me read this. Apparently this law had been enacted. Okay, that's a law. You can't serve as a witness if you yourself are guilty of it. Apparently this law had been enacted as a safeguard to deter false accusations. False witnesses would be far less likely to testify if their own hand had to begin the process of stoning. especially if they were guilty of the crime themselves and therefore considered a false witness in the case. The punishment for the crime of perjury or of serving as a false witness in a court case was also clearly spelled out. If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days. And the judges shall make careful inquiry, and indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you. Okay? So if you're a false witness in a case, the punishment that you receive is the punishment, is the same punishment which the person who was the, who was convicted by your false testimony. So if it's a capital crime like adultery and you're proven to be a false witness, then that might be you the one who gets stoned, instead of the other person. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. And so to my point here, I don't think we can use John 8 to say that Jesus did away with the law. Jesus is in fact appealing to the law the whole way. He is without fault. It's an allusion back there to Deuteronomy 19. You're not in violation of this law. Let you cast the first stone because you are one of the witnesses. They all walk away one by one. Now, and of course, there's still the whole issue of, you know, what to do under Roman law and everything. But we need to ask ourselves the question, how could Jesus be certain the scribes and Pharisees would all leave one by one? How did he know that they wouldn't ignore their consciences and maybe begin the process of execution? I think it's possible that John is giving us some other clues to help us see why Jesus knew that would happen. It's important to point out that John inserts twice that Jesus stooped down and he wrote on the ground as though he did not hear the Pharisees. And this has always been one of these questions, you know, why are we twice told, you know, Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground? We have to remember that he's writing on the ground in the temple courtyard. Okay? That's where this takes place. So, what's going on there? Well, I think Jesus is doing something I think his accusers picked up on. Okay? What I'm talking about is this. In Numbers chapter 5, we have a case law or a judicial proceeding that theologians refer to as the ordeal of jealousy. And what it was a provision in the law for a man to bring his wife to justice in the event she was suspected of adultery. Now, from what we know of the time, this law, because of the moral laxity of the time, had fallen into disuse among the Jews. But Christ, being the champion of the law that he was, who came not to destroy the law but to fulfill it, I think he enacts this ordinance. But what he does is he turns it on the scribes and Pharisees. Okay? He turns it not on the woman, but on her accusers, who, by the way, have also usurped the role of the husband in bringing the wife to the judge, the suspected adulteress. Okay? The law's intention is either for the vindication of the innocent or the conviction of the guilty. What happened was the man who suspected his wife of adultery could bring her to the priest and let her be. I'll just read some select verses from Numbers 5. You can go back and look at it for yourself. The law says, the priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel, Remember what we said about the symbolism associated with the Feast of Tabernacles, water and light, okay? The priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. According to the law, the woman is made to drink of a portion made up of dust from the temple floor and consecrated water used to wash off the ritual curses written on a parchment, okay? Verse 23, then the priest shall write these curses in a book, and he shall scrape them off into the bitter water. And he shall make the woman drink the bitter water that brings a curse. And the water that brings the curse shall enter her to become bitter. If she's guilty, the drink will prove unsafe. If innocent, she'll suffer no harm. Verse 27. I left off my end of my quotes there somewhere. Sorry. When he has made her drink the water, then it shall be, if she has defiled herself and behaved unfaithfully toward her husband, that the water that brings the curse will enter her and become bitter, and her belly will swell, and her thigh rot, and the woman will become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, then she shall be free and may conceive children. Okay? So she's to be brought to the temple. You're to take water and you're to write curses in a book, on a parchment, and you're to scrape off these curses that are written into the water. She drinks the solution. If she's guilty, then her belly, her right thigh swell. Okay? According to rabbis, it's because she's conceived in her stomach by spreading her thighs. Okay, that's the rabbinic interpretation. If she's innocent, then there's, you know, that will not happen, and she'll be free. She can conceive children. Okay. Let me mention here that what we see in the ordeal of jealousy is basically what we see at Mount Sinai after the golden calf incident. Okay? You remember the situation, Moses up on the mountain. The people engage in idolatry at the base. Moses comes down, he takes the tablets of stone, he grinds them to powder, he pours them in river at the base, a stream at the base of Sinai, and makes the people to drink of. Now, we're not told back then what happens in this situation, but we can surmise that the people who drank the solution were identified in some way, perhaps in the same way, because Moses then commands the people to kill the adulterers. The tribe of Levi rise up to kill the ones who had committed idolatry at Mount Sinai. It is for that reason the Levites are awarded the priesthood later. Okay? And that episode is foreshadowing, you know, Jesus' words, he who, you know, loves father and mother more than me will not be worthy of me. Okay? You have to put Christ first. That's what the Levites had done in that episode. Okay? So what you see in the ordeal of jealousy then is a personal application of what was performed at Mount Sinai. Now, the interesting thing is that we know it was held among the Jews that if the husband himself was guilty of adultery, then the test would be ineffective. Letter C here in page 4. So this fact may well explain why John tells us of Jesus writing on the temple floor. What Jesus does in the temple, the very place where this judgment was to be pronounced, was to apply the ordeal of jealousy to the accusers themselves, who stood in the place of the offended husband. Matthew Henry describes the scene. Come then, saith Christ, according to your own tradition will I judge you. If you are without sin, stand to the charge, and let the adulteress be executed. But if not, though she be guilty, while you that present her are equally so, according to your own rule, she shall be set free. Okay? It seems Jesus is by the fact John tells us twice, he writes down and he writes in the dust of the temple floor, which is where the ordeal of jealousy was, you know, was enacted. You write curses and, you know, in that case you pour them in water. It seems as if Jesus is somehow enacting that ordeal. Letter D says, unbeknownst to the Pharisees, they had indeed taken the woman before the Lord into the presence of the incarnate Lord in exact conformity to the law. But Jesus turns the ordeal upon them. When he stooped down to write the curses on the ground, he was pronouncing a bitter sentence against them. When by his Holy Spirit, our great high priest in his human flesh addressed the adulterers, he did indeed present them with living water in an earthen vessel. They were compelled to drink the water of conviction themselves. The result, then those who heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, being with the oldest even to the least. See, we hear that phrase from verse 8 and we think, oh, well, all the Pharisees felt guilty because they had committed sins before. I don't think that's the case. I think they felt guilty because Jesus had nailed them with the ordeal of jealousy. That's a whole lot of stuff there. Yeah, questions or comments?
Well, let's say, just a quick question. The woman drank it and all that, and it was determined that she had been unfaithful. But they set about then to try to find out who she had been with.
Yeah, the law was that both adulterer and adulteress should have been. And again, that was the problem. The Pharisees, where was the man? I don't know. I think there's an assumption there that if he suspects her of it, that, you know, he knows something going on. I don't know. I don't know why I answer that. How could they prove? I don't know. Yes, sir.
The ordeal of jealousy doesn't involve the civil ministry bringing a sentence, rather it involves the woman suffering disease.
Yeah, but I wonder if, I mean, I know the ordeal of jealousy says nothing about the civil punishment of it, but now that he has a conviction, he has a twofold witness, the swollen stomach and right thigh, would that not serve in a court of law afterwards?
No, you read the details of the thing about adultery earlier. If a man is guilty of adultery, he and the woman. But that law doesn't apply when the ordeal is applied to a woman.
I still don't know why it would not, unless if there is a conviction by the twofold witness she has. I mean, the ordeal of jealousy has in effect convicted her of. And let me say, I don't think in most cases. Remember, capital crime was the ultimate that could be asked for by the victim of the crime. It doesn't mean that it would have to be enforced. So I'd have to think more about this, but I don't know why there couldn't also be a civil punishment on top. Many situations, it may be just a divorce. Again, for all of those, the only thing, only murder required capital punishment. Other things could be up to, and that was like the limit. And in most cases, there wouldn't have been. And oftentimes, there would have been financial compensation, etc.
One more. He
just was going to put her away. Yeah. Do it privately. And I would suspect more often than not, that would be the situation. The guy said, I'm divorcing you. You've committed adultery. You know? Especially if he had any, you know, care, if he cared for her at all. You know? All right. Well, that, I think, given the fact that John tells us we're in the temple floor, Jesus is writing in the dust of the temple floor, and these things, I think there is very likely an allusion back to the ordeal of jealousy. One other thing, and this is, like I said, I didn't know if we get to this or not. There's been a lot of speculation. What did Jesus write? And we can't come out and say what Jesus wrote. However, it is significant to point out that it says he wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear. Okay? Jesus' finger is the finger of God, obviously. And we hear about the finger of God a few times in Scripture. You hear about it the first time, I think it is, in Exodus 8, when Moses does battle with Pharaoh's magicians, and his miracles trump Pharaoh's magicians, and they complain that his are done by the finger of God. Later on, then, in Exodus 31, when the Ten Commandments are written, they're specifically said to have been written with the finger of God. Okay? It says, two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone, written with the finger of God. Then finally, Jesus says, you know, if I cast out demons by the finger of God, then, you know, the kingdom of God has come upon you. So we have a few instances of the finger of God in the Bible. And I guess one other, it says a finger of a man's hand, but it's sent from God, is in Daniel chapter 5. There's a famous scene. Belshazzar he's holding a big feast. He's celebrating his kingdom and its exploits. And during this feast, he brings out the furniture from the temple of Jerusalem that had been captured in the conquest of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. And he asked for all the gold and silver vessels to be taken, to brought in, so that they can eat and drink from them. And, you know, the lampstand, all that furniture and everything that had been captured. And like Nebuchadnezzar, he failed to realize who had given him that kingdom and gained him all that wealth. And because of his pride, we're told that shining on the wall from the light from the tabernacle lampstand or temple lampstand was a message of judgment from the Lord. And this is Daniel 5, verse 5. In the same hour, the finger of a man's hand appeared. I'm on the last page now, page 5. And wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. Okay? So there's this note, and it's in Aramaic. Alright? And the lampstand that's been brought out is shining on the wall, and you see it. Okay? Letter D. Prophet Daniel interpreted. Verse 24 says, then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this is sent from God, and this writing was written. And this is the inscription that was written. Many, many tekel upharsin. Okay, which translated as you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. So Belshazzar's kingdom was going to be taken and given to another. So verse 30 says, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. It's significant to note that right after, going back to John 8 now, after all the Pharisees walk away, Jesus says, where are your accusers? Has no one condemned you? She says, no one, Lord. Jesus said to her, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Jesus stands up and he says, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of light. Is it possible that what Jesus wrote on the ground was, if we had to venture a guess, many, many tekel upharsin? They had been weighed in the balance and found wanting. If we had to venture a guess, that to me is the most likely scenario of anything, given the connection with Belshazzar, what was written in regard to him, with the light from the lampstand shining, the message on the wall, Jesus standing up and declaring himself to be, in essence, the fulfillment of that lampstand. We know that lampstand represented God. You remember inside the holy place, you had the loaves on the table of showbread or face bread. And there's 12 loaves for the 12 tribes of Israel, and the lamp faced those 12 loaves. Okay? And it represented Israel basking in the light of God's presence. Okay? That's what we mean when we, you know, in our benediction each week, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his face upon you, literally, and give you peace. Okay? So, you know, can we prove this? I don't think so, but it is interesting to consider. If that's a possibility, you know, why does John tell us Jesus wrote? Why are they convicted? Why do they walk away? I think there's too much going on in this passage to not think this is authentic. There's too many allusions back to the Old Testament. So I think there's very likely something there. I think future generations will probably, you know, say something with a little more certainty. But, you know, I thought it'd be fun to explore some of those issues. But more than that, to show, there's no indication here Jesus has done away with the Old Testament law. Okay? And that's the thing I want to prove above all else. Pharisees are trying to trap him. He turns the tables on them. And in the process, he upholds the validity of the law throughout. When he says he is without fault, let him cast the first stone. That's simply calling upon the enforcement of the law. Same thing in regard to the end, when he asked her about her witnesses. She has none. Jesus knows she's done it. He says, go and sin no more. But without the requirements of the law, remember what we said, without the witnesses, there can be no conviction. Okay, there are safeguards in place. So, a lot of stuff there. What, any more, any questions or comments?